Good morning and welcome to Take AIM, Accuracy in Media's weekly talk show on Blog Talk Radio. AIM is America's original media watchdog, and every week we point out biased coverage and bring you the stories the mainstream media ignore. We encourage you to visit our website at aim.org and sign up to receive our daily email so you can keep track of what the media are up to. I'm Roger Aronoff, a media analyst with AIM, joined today by my co-host Don Irvine, Accuracy in Media's chairman. Good morning, Don.
Hey, Roger.
How are you today?
Doing fine. How about you?
Good. So today we have a great guest. She's not on the line just yet, but we will talk a little bit about her. We have Michelle Malkin, who is an absolute superstar in the world of new media. She founded two of the Internet's top conservative blogs, MichelleMalkin.com and HotAir.com, two kind of must-view blogs in the conservative world. Before that, she worked as a newspaper journalist. She writes a nationally syndicated column. She's been a Fox News Channel contributor since 2001. And is the author of four best-selling books. The latest is just out. It's called The Culture of Corruption, subtitle Obama and His Team of Tax Cheats, Crooks, and Cronies. And most importantly of all, Michelle won the Reed Irvine Accuracy in Media Award for Investigative Journalism in 2007 for a series of columns she wrote in 2006 on the issue of illegal immigration. So as soon as she calls in, we will talk to her, but she's not there just yet. So anyway, let me just talk about something that we have just put up on our website this morning and is going out as part of our daily email today. That is an article by Alana Goodman. Now, Alana is part of our American Journalism Center, an intern program we have here at AIM, and she has done a great piece that really exposes the hypocrisy of the left in their attacks on these town hall meetings. And it's called Campus Progress Mob Rules, and I urge everyone to visit our website, aim.org, and under briefings you will find that. Don, why don't you tell them a little more about the American Journalism Center and what that program is all about.
Sure. The American Journalism Center is a project we started just a few years ago in an effort to train young conservatives, mainly in the field of journalism, but we also train them in marketing and public relations as well as broadcast journalism as part of it, not just the written part. And we've had a number of very fine students that have come through the program in the last few years. They got an opportunity to come to D.C., live in D.C., collect a small stipend, and then write and report on many different subjects and issues. We try to make it something that they will get to report on things that they're naturally interested in, but it's also used as an opportunity to kind of expand their mind and show them some different things. So they've covered stories by covering the Center for American Progress events. They cover a lot of conservative events. Frequently, the students find themselves as really the only reporting going on at any of these events. You may see some of the events being webcast and things like that or streamed live, but you'll rarely see many of these events actually being reported in the mainstream press of any kind. So it's been a great program. We've had a great time with the students. As you mentioned, Alana's pieces this summer, the particular one that she just did. We've also had some very good success with doing some video work with the interns, having interviewed Congressman Price this summer, Congressman Bachman, Fred Singer, who's an expert on global warming. I just interviewed Charles Murray just a few weeks ago, as well as getting the interns a chance to go out there and then do a little bit of their own reporting and, on the video side. We have on our website a video that students went to They were going to an ACORN type rally on healthcare. They interviewed some young ladies that were affiliated with ACORN and got some what I would think were some choice comments and words out of them. This has become for us our best, most viewed video on our YouTube channel, on our website. And we continue to try to work with them and try to find things like that. The Michelle Bachmann interview that we did got picked up by Talking Points Memo, a very big liberal blog, and boosted that viewership up a little bit as well. So we think we give them a really great experience to be here in D.C., to learn a lot. They get a lot of training in the sense of they can enhance their writing skills. Many of them come in as very good writers, but I think they leave as much better writers and reporters. And from everything I've heard from all the interns, they really have enjoyed the opportunity to be in D.C. and to see things that they normally wouldn't have seen. So I think that kind of wraps it up or something.
Well, another thing about it is some of it appears on the AIM.org website, but all of it appears on the campusreportonline.net is the website, I believe. And that's our sister organization, Accuracy in Academia. And the thing is we do something that really no one in this entire city does with that, and that our interns are out at all these various think tanks and advocacy groups and like Heritage. I believe our guest is with us now, so let's go right to her, Don. Gonna get Michelle on. Hi, Michelle, are you on?
I am. Hi.
Great. We're so happy to have you. Well, you missed your introduction, and we talked all about your books. This is Roger Aronoff, and Don Irvine are here as the host today.
It's great to talk to both of you and rejoin you again. And, you know, I've long admired and supported the work of AIM, so glad to be here.
Well, thanks. One of the things we mentioned, is, of course, is that you won the Reed Irvine Accuracy in Media Award for Investigative Journalism in 2007 for the work you did on the issue of illegal immigration. So,
I was most honored, and I still have the plaque right here in my home office.
Terrific. Well, so let's get started. We've got so many things we'd like to talk to you about. We'll get right into your book and the culture of corruption. But here in less than 6 months into the Barack Obama presidency, you were out with this book. And it is a great read, and it's rich in detail and facts that they're going to have a really hard time running from. And one of the points that is fascinating is the number of so-called czars that Obama has appointed, which seems to fly in the face of the new era of transparency and accountability that Obama promised us. Tell us about the czars and why this is a problem.
Yeah, well, what's unprecedented is the amount of them and the compromised quality of the entire lot, frankly. There are upwards of 44 of these presidential appointees now currently in the Obama administration. And as you point out, Roger, no congressional oversight, very little public scrutiny. The public is not apprised of the budgets, the personnel, and the purview. I mean, many of them are completely superfluous. And I point out in the book, for example, that we have an urban czar, despite the fact that we already have a confirmed Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. We have a healthcare czar completely separate from the confirmed Secretary of Health and Human Services. And it raises a lot of troubling questions about the authority and the jurisdiction of these overlapping czars. And I've been able to shed a little bit of light on some of the, in some cases, criminal backgrounds of some of these czars and very shady records, and also clear potential conflicts of interest. Conflicts of interest that if it were Republicans in these offices, it would, of course, be front-page news and the subject of New York Times editorial jihads every day. And the healthcare czar is of particular concern. Nancy DeParle was a former Clintonite. She ran Medicare and Medicaid, and then she parlayed that government stint into a very lucrative private career, served on many boards of directors of various healthcare firms. She consulted. She made, as I said, upwards of $6 million, which, of course, I don't have a problem with people making money in the private market, but this is the same market that Barack and Michelle Obama are now trying to destroy. And the White House has been meeting in secret with some of these healthcare executives and refuses to say which administration officials sat in on them. And I reported a couple of weeks ago that some of these officials had direct financial ties to Nancy DeParl. I mean, where are the rest of the watchdogs to illuminate these potential conflicts of interest and beat the drum about them? They're nowhere. That's why I wrote the book.
Hi, Michelle. It's Don Irvine.
Hey, Don.
Good to talk with you.
Me too.
This is something I blogged on a little bit earlier this year that you also mentioned in the book, I guess, I'm talking about. Another promise that Obama made was regarding his promise to not appoint lobbyists to the administration. That didn't seem to hold up very long, did it?
It certainly did not, and there are dozens of them, of course, now. And again, it's fairly business as usual, but of course they've had to hand out waivers like Pez Candy or argue that some of these lobbyists really weren't technically lobbyists. And this is a problem in both the West Wing and the East Wing, as well as, I think, of particular note, Don, all of the former lobbyists for Goldman Sachs and various big businesses that are now populating the Treasury Department. Nobody else wants to take those positions. And they've never directly confronted the straight, blatant, naked hypocrisy of what they promised and then what they delivered.
Now, what about the people he appointed, like Tom Daschle and Tim Geithner, who've had some tax problems? Do you think this was due to bad vetting, dishonesty, or did he think that we just weren't going to find out?
All of that, coupled with, of course, the trademark narcissism and hubris of Team Obama. It's just amazing to me that given all the hype about the fresh politics of Washington, that among the first people they put forth for nomination is the consummate Washington insider, Tom Daschle. And knowing how knee-deep he was in those pay-for-play scandals with the failure to pay hundreds of thousands of taxes on the crony driver, and they knew all of that. I mean, that's what's astonishing to me, that this crack team that was hailed by both the left and some of the enamored right, including David Brooks, who called this the best of the Washington insiders, the Achievatrons, the Enarchs, you know, the French-like elite with all of their Ivy League degrees. And yet this is what they give us. And, of course, that's just one layer of it. It's not just the folks who didn't make it through, but, of course, we mentioned everybody knows about Tim Geithner. It's the people who barely made it through the nomination process by the skin of their teeth. And so many of them with these do-as-I-say-not-as-I-do attitudes about taxes and about laws not applying to them. Hilda Solis, the labor secretary, who was lobbying for legislation that she was co-sponsoring. I mean, the fact that these people got through, I think, is not just an indictment of the Obama administration, but certainly an indictment of all those feckless Republicans who went along and rubber-stamped so many of those confirmations.
Now, we'll come back to the book in a second, but you had a great column out yesterday called Brown Shirts versus Purple Shirts. And the reference is to this fight over who the real bullies and thugs are at all the town hall meetings. And the left is accusing the right of organizing to get people out to these meetings. You point out that the left is really better organizing and acting more like thugs, and that it's sort of with a wink and a nod from the Obama administration. Tell us what you found out in researching that article.
Oh, yeah. One of the chapters in the book is on the Service Employees International Union, and I always advise to look for the union label because, the SEIU is 1.8 million members strong. And we all know that they extract those forced dues out of many rank-and-file members who simply don't agree with this hard-left political agenda. But the SEIU poured upwards of $80 million into Democrat campaign coffers, and a third to a half of that went directly to elect Barack Obama, and in an attempt so far unchallenged to secure a Democrat majority in perpetuity. The SEIU is the true mob. I mean, these are the real brown shirts, and they have a long history of violence and aggression and intimidation, not only against their corporate targets and universities that they're trying to foist exclusive collective bargaining agreements on, but also against their own rank and file. And I think that it really is the dirty little secret. And certainly the mainstream media does not want to pursue that narrative, because they cast these big labor bosses as the champions of the little people and blue collar workers and low skilled service workers. It's not true. And anyone who has paid attention at all to these various embezzlement scandals, for example, and the violence that occurred last year between the SEIU and a union competitor over representation of nurses, it's some of the lefties online who even blew the whistle on this tactic of busing in from out of state these mobs of purple shirts to intimidate speakers and intimidate negotiators. You don't hear about that. And instead, the Washington Post and the New York Times let the White House and the Democrat majority get away with these smears of ordinary peaceful people who are simply trying to make themselves heard at these town halls.
This week we saw Hillary in Africa when she thought she was being asked about Bill's opinion on something, which kind of reminded me of when she was first nominated to be Secretary of State, and there were a lot of questions raised about how this would work out with Bill going around the globe collecting huge amounts of money from businessmen and politicians and countries that seemed like they would inevitably create conflicts of interest. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, I dedicated a whole chapter to these potential conflicts of interest in culture of corruption. And it's just, again, you just have to laugh at Obama, the ultimate agent of transparency, appointing to the Secretary of State position someone whose entire life has been the antithesis of transparency. And, I didn't waste time going through all the Travelgate and secret healthcare task force gate and Whitewater gate and every other gate from the original Clinton era, but did spend a lot of time talking about how the Clintons both had refused and fought off for so long any disclosure of the foreign government donors and very shady international businessmen who've donated millions of dollars to Clinton's charitable foundations. And this came up during the confirmation hearing in a very ginger way, gingerly approached way. Republican Senator Lugar brought up the troubling problem of having these entities who had donated to the Clinton Foundation, and not only the perception, but the probable reality that there would be conflicts of interest. And the ultimate resolution of that was basically for the Clintons to say, trust us, and for all of the capitulationists in the Senate to say, okay, there still is not completely full disclosure of those donors, and we're supposed to trust her to recuse herself on her own accord. And it really is a wolf in sheep's clothing or a fox guarding the hen house problem. And everyone in Washington just sort of shrugged their shoulders and went along with it.
Well, while we're still on the Clintons, what was your impression or your opinion of Bill's trip to North Korea?
Well, I mean, the first thing, of course, is that I am genuinely relieved that those two journalists are home. But the question is, at what cost? And we had to, suffer through this entire farce of Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama trying to convince us this was merely a private trip on the part of the man who just happens to be the former president of the United States and the current husband of the Secretary of State of our country. And I'm very concerned about what exactly was offered and accepted in return for those two journalists' freedom.
Now, what about Joe Biden and Michelle Obama? How do they fit into this culture of corruption? And what other examples can you give us about corruption and cronyism that you've discovered?
I think that the Michelle Obama is a very rich case study in herself, and her entire political career is a teachable moment for the American electorate. She has benefited enormously from nepotism and cronyism, a literal heir to the Chicago patronage system. Her father was a patronage appointee under Daley. And then was able to flit from Princeton to Harvard, back to Sidley and Austin, one of the most prestigious law firms in Chicago, let alone the country, and then to a cozy position in the Daley administration, and then to the University of Chicago Medical Center. And yet, despite all of those blessings in this wonderful country, has been able to exploit the racial resentment card for her entire career and unchallenged. There are very few public critics outside of those of us on the right side of the aisle who will question her political pedigree and her history at the University of Chicago Medical Center, where she foisted this patient dumping scheme on poor and minority patients there. There are very few questions openly in the pages of the New York Times or the Washington Post or on Katie Couric's Nightly News about the kind of power that she's wielding now in the East Wing. She brought over all of these Chicago cronies to the East Wing. Susan Scher, the woman who hired her at the University of Chicago and also worked with her in the Daley administration, now her chief of staff. Valerie Jarrett, who serves as the consigliere to both of the Obamas and floats back between the West Wing and the East Wing, also a former Daley operative, who presided over a slum project that only the Boston Globe sought to highlight and expose during the campaign last year. And it's frustrating to me that even now, all we get from most of the mainstream press and the fashion magazines and the gossip magazines is obsessions with what she's wearing and how toned her arms are. This is a woman who has been implicated in the firing of the AmeriCorps Inspector General. Where is the investigation of that? Only in the niche press, magazines that actually cover the national service industry, and it is an industry, have mentioned the fact that she has played a role in installing her left-hand women, right-hand man, left-hand women, as legal counsels at AmeriCorps, and has taken a vested interest in stocking AmeriCorps with her cronies. It's troubling, but you're not going to hear about it, and that's why I thought it was very important to include that chapter, and it's the one that apparently riles my opponents the most.
Well, put on your media watchdog hat for a minute and give us kind of your review of the media's coverage of the Obama administration so far. I mean, you've made a few mentions of it, but do you find it fair and balanced, or would you say it's more in the tank for Obama? And give me a couple of your favorite examples.
Yeah. Incredibly in the tank, of course. And I would note a few exceptions, and I note this in the book and give credit to many local-based reporters, particularly in Chicago, and then I mentioned, of course, this Boston Globe reporter, and also niche reporters, some of the financial reporters and financial blogs, for that matter, have done a much better job than their mainstream, deep-pocketed colleagues and peers on pursuing things like the Wall Street Money Men, the failed bailout architects, and the decisions that they've made that have benefited their friends on Wall Street. David Brooks is one of my favorite examples, and I open up the entire book, the introduction, with a really egregiously obnoxious column that he did last November presaging the success of the greatest transition in world history. And there's never any retractions and never any acknowledgments from these people about how deathly wrong they were.
Well, we saw you on The View, and so I just want to get a little behind-the-scenes story from you going toe-to-toe with Joy Behar, and, you know, when the cameras weren't rolling, what happened? Tell us how
yeah.
that experience was.
Well, it was pretty joyless on the studio set, I'll have to tell you, and I came prepared. You know, I've been in the print journalism business for almost 17 years now, and doing TV, which in some cases I view as a occupational hazard, for about a decade. And I think all of us as conservatives learned to be prepared and be armed and consider these forums lion's dens. And, you know, unfortunately, I'd seen too many Republican politicians in particular go there unprepared and then get completely steamrolled. And that certainly was the case with John McCain when he appeared on The View with his wife. And you can't do that. My goodness, somebody with as storied a war history as his gets steamrolled by these silly women? It looked bad for our side, I think, and for our movement. And I think that there are a lot of people in the Beltway establishment and the Manhattan cocktail circuit who don't want to be seen as rude. They have this chromosomal problem of wanting to be liked by people who hate them. And I think that we have to get over that if we're going to fight back, and certainly if we're going to fight back against these Chicago politicos. I mean, it's no holds barred for them every time, and sometimes we have to, you know, take the fight to them, and that's what happened. And I was actually surprised at how ill-prepared they were, and I think the ultimate example of that was when Whoopi Goldberg had to resort to waving a producer's note card in my face to justify her mischaracterizing what I've said and what I said in the book.
I spoke to Representative Michelle Bachmann a few weeks ago. We discussed ACORN and the census. What's the deal with ACORN and the Obama administration itself, and what are the ramifications of this relationship?
One of my favorite figures in political life, Kris Kobach, was a former Bush administration official. He worked on immigration enforcement and counterterrorism policy, went back to the state of Kansas and headed up the Kansas GOP and is now running for Secretary of State, put it so well and so succinctly. In announcing his candidacy for Secretary of State a couple of months ago, he said, ACORN is a criminal enterprise, and that's exactly right. That the voter fraud registration that we've seen through ACORN over the last couple of election cycles is really just the tip of the iceberg. That, in fact, this welfare rights organization over the last 30 years that has benefited from 40% in government funding, taxpayer funding, is dedicated to a really radical transformation of the entire electoral and economic landscape. They recruit these members, they pay their dues, and then they use them as foot soldiers to bully and intimidate their political and corporate enemies. And they've used this vast network of some 200 tax-exempt, nonprofit, supposedly nonpartisan affiliates to do their business and bidding. One of the biggest lies from the last election cycle was Obama telling us that he had nothing to do with ACORN when Project Vote, the Get Out the Vote organization that he was head of in Chicago, is inextricably linked to ACORN. And that's the case, of course, with many of these front groups, including Citizens Services, Inc., which got $832,000 directly from the Obama campaign, which acknowledged belatedly to the FEC that, oh, well, that's not campaign expenditures, that's really get out the vote expenditures. And this is the shell game that they play. And fortunately, we do have alert and informed congresswomen and congressmen, including Michelle Bachmann, Steve King of Iowa, who get it now. In the House Oversight Committee, Republicans did a very good report a couple of weeks ago outlining just how extensive the racket was. But, you know, this is very daunting for Republicans because we've allowed this to happen for the last 30, 35 years. 8 years we had the majority and Bush in office, and they didn't do anything about it. And, you know, it's kind of disturbing because in a way it's almost too late to undo a lot of the damage that they've done and the competitive advantage they have as well. You know, now these people are going to be collecting census data.
Michelle, can you stay with us a couple more minutes?
Yes.
Okay, thanks. We know you created Hot Air and MichelleMalkin.com. You have two, they are two of the most popular blog sites. How is the new media environment affecting the political realities out there today? Tell us about your take on that.
It's critical, and I think that's what inspires and encourages me the most. Because the synergy between the internet, traditional talk radio, blog talk radio, the blogs, and especially organizing and communication tools like Twitter and Facebook have made it more possible than ever for this grassroots conservative revolt and counterinsurgency to take place. And, you know, I was amazed back in February when this bona fide grassroots Tea Party sprung up at how effective and how useful Twitter was as a tool to get people in touch with each other. You know, one of the funniest smears and attacks from the White House and the Democrats about this Tea Party movement is that it's somehow top-down and organized by Republicans. Don't we Republicans wish they had been organized and on top of things? I just have to chuckle every time I hear that one. And, of course, we talked about the double standards and the hypocrisy of the left, which, of course, has nothing but this top-down direction of its minions and its mob rules, you know, mobsters doing their bidding.
Listen, you show so much courage in putting all this stuff out there, and you speak so eloquently about it. Were there any efforts to intimidate you or otherwise try to keep you from writing this book or to block your publisher from putting it out? Anything that you can tell us about?
No, nothing official, although, you know, you've seen the derision and the mockery and the whitewashing from many folks on the left, cable TV people and so-called comics trying to put down the book without, of course, ever reading a single page of it. And then you've got your big institutions like the New York Times and the Washington Post, which you know, will not treat conservative books with respect. It's not just my book. It's, you know, the four or five other conservative books that are on the New York Times list despite their best efforts to ignore us. You know, over the years, I've experienced plenty of that. I think there's an extra onus on minority conservatives in particular and playing the race card and accusing us of being shills for the white man and traitors to our race. But, you know, you grow a thick skin and, you know, you learn how to pick and choose your battles. And then, of course, I've gotten so much support over the years from groups like yours, folks on the Internet and the grassroots. And I've always said, you know, even when my first book came out, Invasion, that I don't take for granted the freedoms that I have here. I am grateful every day for being able to make a living mouthing off and doing what I do and writing, which I love and I have always loved doing and communicating. And I know a lot of people were very dispirited after this last election, but look what's happened. You know, people are more active and involved than ever. They're listening to internet radio. They're circumventing the dinosaur monopoly, and that monopoly is falling, and these papers are closing up, and the ratings are cratering. It's a great time to be a conservative in America.
So one final thing. We just want you to tell people how they can find your book and if there are any final thoughts you want to convey to us before we let you go.
Oh, well, just thank you, and thanks to all the folks out there who support what we all do, and especially, I mean, it's just been especially gratifying to see people buy up the book, spread the word. I'm so humbled and heartened by that. Folks can get it on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, hopefully at their local chain bookstores or independent stores and just keep spreading the word. The truth will out, and on to 2010 and 2012.
Thank you so much for being with us. It's been great, and we'll be watching and listening, and good luck to you.
Thanks, Roger. Thanks, Don.
Okay.
Thanks,
bye-bye. Well, that was great. Now we have our other guest on the line, so we're going to get right into that. Let's see. Claudia Rosette, are you there on the line with us now?
Yes, I am. Good morning.
Hi. How are you?
Hi. Fine, thanks. How are you?
Great. This is Roger Aronoff, and Don Irvine is the co-host, and looking forward to talking to you about a lot of different things this next half hour. So,
sure, with pleasure.
Let me introduce you. Claudia is a journalist in residence with the Foundation for Defense for the Defense of Democracy. She writes a weekly column on foreign affairs for Forbes magazine or Forbes.com. She spent a number of years with the Wall Street Journal as the editorial page editor of the Asian Wall Street Journal and later as the Moscow bureau chief of the Wall Street Journal. So welcome to Take Aim, and why don't you start out telling us a little more about yourself? Where did you go to school? How did you come by your interest in foreign affairs?
I have a BA from Yale and an MA in English poetry from Columbia and an MBA from the University of Chicago, which is sort of a mix of finance and poetry. Mm-hmm. And I love to travel. My family spent time living in Taiwan and in Holland when I was little, and I guess a marvelous mix of that was to go work overseas for the Wall Street Journal for many years in the Far East in the former Soviet Union. And since 1997, I've been back in the United States. The main story I've covered in recent years has been corruption at the United Nations, especially the oil for food scandal. I write mainly on democratic dissidents and related movements and on tyrannies, basically, mm-hmm. and the interesting things they do and the problems that these create.
Which also ties into your work at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, which is the group started by Cliff May, himself a former journalist with the New York Times and Newsweek. Tell us a little about what they're up to these days.
Sure. Their interest is especially in ways of trying to tackle the problem of terrorism. As the name of the foundation says, defending democracies.
Mm-hmm.
They've been looking especially at matters such as how to try to do something to stop Iran's acquisition of nuclear weapons. They've been particularly looking at what might be done by way of trying to cut off gasoline sales to Iran, which depends greatly on gasoline imports. They don't have the refining capacity. The FDD has been working on projects like trying to shut down terrorist broadcasting in the United States, where outfits like terrorist groups backed by Iran, such as Hezbollah, have been caught by, in fact, there have been convictions in federal court, broadcasting terrorist propaganda into the United States. On my own account, I write a weekly column for Forbes online. You can find it every Thursday in their opinion section. I'm one of their regular columnists. I write a column called Freedom's Edge. And I write about tend to focus especially on various rogue states and what they're up to. This week I wrote something about the, quote, disappointing nature of the language of modern diplomacy, where I've heard the words disappointing and unacceptable applied at this point by the White House to everything from letting children get fat to Iran getting nuclear weapons, and think it's time we really stopped using the vocabulary we employ with four-year-olds to address people who are the rulers of countries that really do threaten us. And last week, for instance, I wrote about Bill Clinton's trip to North Korea to bring home Al Gore's two employees. I'm hesitating at this point to call them journalists, the two women who were picked up by North Korea, apparently having actually crossed into North Korea along the Chinese border in March.
Hi, Claudia. This is Don.
Hi, Don. How are you?
Fine. This is actually the leads right into the question that I wanted to ask, which is really about Bill Clinton's trip to North Korea. You definitely have some concerns here about that. I think you agree that their release from captivity was a good thing. But did President Clinton really give up too much when he posed with a photo with Kim Jong-il? You said in your article, for example, that the implications are that this is, quote, likely to haunt and harm us all. What are you referring to?
The fact that Bill Clinton went there at all was a terrible thing. You know, let's divide this up for sort of addressing more easily the pieces of it. Of course, we're glad when people who are effectively held hostage come home. We always are. At the same time, there's a tremendous cost to playing into hostage politics, and that is what this was. The two women working for Al Gore's current TV station, or whatever, the cable station, made a terrible miscalculation. We now learn that they did apparently cross into North Korea. That's what one of them told CNN, or at least she did. And I question, to what extent were we talking about journalists here? I was up at that same border area myself almost a year ago, in September of last year. And one of the things that you see, if you look carefully along the North Korean bank of the river that runs along the border, is there are sentry huts containing armed guards, usually three of them, every few hundred yards along that bank. And they're mostly there to make sure that North Koreans don't get out. But it is crazy to think that you could cross over there and that they would not know that you were doing that. That's first point. Second is, once these women were caught, the sentence they were given was outrageous. That was North Korea working the situation. You know, we wait to find out, were they lured to this, what happened, but 12 years hard labor, North Korea runs a gulag that is notorious for people dying of overwork, starvation, exposure, or outright being executed. And hundreds of thousands of North Koreans are estimated to be in there. It's one of the ways that the North Korean government keeps control. And the prospect of these two American women ending up in that for 12 years, which could kill you, was, of course, awful. So, terrible prospect. And at the same time, the idea that North Korea could sentence them to this and then a former president of the United States would go over to Pyongyang and effectively receive the favor of amnesty from Kim Jong-il, the dictator of North Korea, that's crazy. That's going way too far. And the way that this worked, we're learning bits about this story as the women now back in the United States leak out their tale. I expect at some point we'll see it in fuller version, but one of them was allowed to phone her sister while they were being held in detention. And I should say here, North Korea was clearly planning to do some deal. They apparently did not actually send these two women to a real labor camp. They held them in the relative comfort of some sort of detention, which must have been terrifying. That would be a very terrible thing to be in. At the same time, they were not actually sent to the kind of thing that would happen to a North Korean who was sentenced to this kind of time in these camps. One of these women phoned her family in the States and effectively transmitted the message she'd received from North Korean authorities that if Bill Clinton were to come, they might be released. So basically, North Korea wanted Bill Clinton to come over and be seen discussing with Kim Jong-il. And that in itself, consider the disparity here. North Korea is effectively a criminal state, a murderous criminal state, which is one of the worst, most repressive governments on the planet. A million people or more starved to death under that regime within the past 12 years, needlessly. That was a function of politics. On the other side of the DMZ in South Korea, people were doing just fine. North Korea is under sanctions by both the U.S. and the U.N. They have an astounding record of peddling missiles into the Middle East, of helping Syria build a nuclear reactor, a secret nuclear reactor, presumably to make weapons on the Euphrates River, the one that the Israelis bombed 2 years ago. They have been caught dealing narcotics out of their embassies. They counterfeit U.S. currency. You know, the list is incredible. That in itself is an act of war. And North Korea has long wanted bilateral talks with the United States. That Kim Jong-il basically could snap his fingers and Bill Clinton would fly over there. And then it would be hailed by President Obama as a triumph when Bill Clinton got back. That broadcast to the whole world the message that all you need to do is scarf up two American hostages and the U.S. will roll over and thank you for their release. That's a very bad trend in world affairs. You know, that's a basic problem with this. Before we even get to the question for which we're still waiting to hear more about, find out more about, of did Bill Clinton arrive with any other offers, deals, and so on? Because North Korea's government has survived for years by being very adept at shaking down countries like the United States. You can call it nuclear extortion. In this case, it was hostage politics, but same M.O.
Obama, too, that kind of went head over heels about this whole Clinton thing. The media obviously hyped this thing up. You know, Bill Clinton comes back, this big hero. But you know, as you've been talking, you know, Kim Jong-il had a plan. I mean, he really only would want to release these ladies, you know, if Clinton came and kind of did his bidding on this, and Clinton would get his assurance that they would leave with him. So, you know, do you see this as a heroic act at all on Clinton's part?
I'm sorry, I actually don't. I think it was a PR stunt. And I think, first of all, the whole, you know, the pretense that he was going as a completely private person, in that case, you know, where's the Logan Act? What business does he have negotiating foreign policy with the likes of Kim Jong-il? He's not president anymore. Second, assuming he clearly had to have some sort of blessing to go. You know, his plane, among other things, he was approaching North Korea in a private plane. Try doing that, you know, without some kind of clearance negotiated on all sides. But the whole arrangement was clearly negotiated in advance. You know, Bill Clinton did fly in there in great danger and then negotiate a deal on the ground. He was there for 2 days. He spent hours talking with Kim Jong-il. There were photo ops. They posed in front of a North Korea propaganda wall mural showing, you know, the great force of nature that's supposed to be Kim Jong-il's government, the Kim dynasty. They had dinner together, and then these two women were allowed on board with film being taken of them romping up the, you know, the plane steps. And the whole thing was the best face you can put on it without knowing what other deals might have, were there actually ransom payments? That would be typical of North Korea to demand cash. They've done it before in dealings with the U.S. Was there some further deal? But even before we get to that, this was an incredible display of toadying to the government of North Korea by a former president of the United States. It was something where, once the women were safely out of the country, President Obama should have spoken up immediately to condemn North Korea, to point to the actual labor camps where those women were going to, you know, were officially sentenced to be sent, to talk about the kind of horrible things that go on. And Bill Clinton should have done the same. Instead, we got tie a yellow ribbon around the old oak tree, you know.
Are you convinced that this really was Kim Jong-il that we saw? Because, you know, all the reports of his health, I thought this person looked pretty healthy. And I haven't seen that speculated on, but I must say I wondered it myself when we saw those photos. Do you have any information on that or any thoughts on that?
Sure. Because you're right. This North Korea is rings within rings. You know, you could do quite a soap opera on that place. In fact, Team America did. This all comes at a time when there's been lots of speculation about the health of Kim Jong-il. He's been looking, over the past year, he's had gone through a period in which he looked at death's door. He disappeared last summer for several months was reported to have had a serious stroke. Then there was a report in the South Korean media that he's dying of pancreatic cancer. He's been looking gaunt. His hair has been thinning and so on. So lots of speculation about, is North Korea heading for the second transition of power since it was set up, founded under the auspices of Stalin's Soviet Union at the end of World War II. And what exactly this was in, there's a lot of this is speculation, which tells you actually how little we know, which tells you why the folly of trying to, why it's extreme folly to think we can strike some deal with North Korea right now or at any point. We actually don't know the state of Kim Jong-il's health. It was interesting to see what Bill Clinton might make of it, but Bill Clinton is not a doctor. He took Secret Service personnel in with him. You know, was there somebody qualified to assess Kim Jong-il's health? We don't really know that. It would be interesting information. But, again, a great many mysteries here. And the thing that we do know is if North Korea is heading for a transition, Kim Jong-il is looking for someone to anoint. Speculation has been that he's picked one of his sons, who's now about 26 years old, Kim Jong-un, educated in Switzerland, but apparently much of the same mold as his father. Yeah. Don't get your hopes up that we might get a liberal young ruler in here. That's kind of what happened with Syria when Bashar Assad took over from his father, you know, the Western-educated ophthalmologist. Syria is as bad or worse than it ever was. North Korea, it has a system which would be very hard for anyone taking it over to really dismantle, go against. You know, something there has to actually collapse for it to end. So you've got this sort of complicated transition possibly in the offing with everybody trying to figure out, is Kim Jong-il dying? Is he recovering? What's wrong with him? What's not wrong? You know, what's going on? We just don't know. He looked better in the pictures. We simply don't know. There are some things where we just have to wait to see. But in all this, if there is a transition in the making, what Bill Clinton's trip has just done is help confirm sort of to the world and inside North Korea that the United States is dealing with Kim Jong-il and will deal with whatever he decides next, which, let me just add, that same Bill Clinton as president made exactly that mistake in 1994 when North Korea was part of a former communist bloc which was just falling apart all over the place. The Soviet Union had imploded 3 years earlier. And yet North Korea did not collapse. Why not? All the conditions were there to make you think that it should have, including the fact that the original dictator, Kim Il-sung, installed by Stalin, died in 1994 as he was making this great crisis threatening to go ahead and make bombs and withdraw from the nuclear non-proliferation treaty. And Bill Clinton, as president, did not sort of say, fine, we'll help nudge you over the cliff. You've lost your Soviet subsidies. You're on the ropes. Instead, Bill Clinton let Jimmy Carter go over there, negotiate a nuclear freeze deal called the Agreed Framework, in which the U.S. began sending large amounts of aid, free fuel, and promised 2 new nuclear reactors to North Korea. Remember that deal? Okay. And it helped sustain Kim Jong-il's regime. It helped perpetuate precisely the nuclear-armed tyranny that just took these young women hostage and that we're now trying to deal with. So here we go, making that mistake again.
I can't resist asking this question since I'm married to a South Korean. With all this stuff going on there in North Korea, what do you see as the implications for the South?
The South has found itself much more of a backbone in recent times. They went through a period of the Sunshine Policy and trying madly to be friendly to North Korea, which didn't really get them anywhere. They got 2 nuclear tests on the north side of the DMZ in exchange for that. But the implications are, I'm just trying to think what to We're seeing things right now that are disquieting. For instance, the chairman of Hyundai just went to North Korea to bring home yet another de facto hostage, a South Korean who was detained there for months. North Korea right now is holding four South Korean fishermen. Hostage politics is big at the moment. What will South Korea do about all this? I'm not sure, but they have the problem that the U.S. is setting a very bad example. What Clinton just did sort of points to renewed efforts for another round of talks, which have failed repeatedly in the sense that North Korea will strike deals and then cheat. And over again, it amounts to North Korea rakes in extortion. And they've done that from South Korea, from China. Well, actually, no, China, I'm sorry, it's not. China supports them. This is a very complicated scene. They've done it from the U.S., from South Korea, from the European Union.
Let me, because there's so many topics we wanted to get to with you, but let me just, because we're running out of time here, but just a couple minutes left, but I'd like to get quick takes from you on the situation with Iran. You wrote about that, about, you know, how they crush the demonstrations and the UN, and basically the U.S. officially were pretty quiet about it, and then Russia, if you could give us about a minute on each, would be great.
Yeah, the situation with Iran is absolutely terrible. The Iranian government continues to pursue nuclear weapons. It's very likely they will have them very, very soon, and there's been endless discussion, and yet nothing gets done to actually stop it. Yeah, Iran at this point has... There are more than 170 sanctioned entities and individuals, and still nothing is actually stopping it. It's clear that they really do want nuclear weapons and that it's going to take something more than UN sanctions and so forth, and yet nothing gets done. The world has basically accepted the slaughter of Iranian protesters in the streets. We all watched the young woman bleed to death, and then... The White House spokesman went on to acknowledge that Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is indeed the reelected president of Iran. The UN sent him a letter saying, you know, congratulations. He's expected to show up to give a speech as the president of Iran at the UN this September, again for the fifth time at the opening of the General Assembly. And Iran continues to threaten the country of Israel, continues to back terrorists in Gaza and Lebanon, continues to make the kind of trouble that has produced terrorist attacks, the spread of this poisonous ideology, and so forth for years. So the situation is very bad, and no sign that that President Obama is doing anything truly effective about it at this point. Instead, he keeps trying to extend this hand, which is going to get us pulled right over the cliff. So that's Iran.
Quick.
I wish I could give you more cheerful words.
I know. Russia, real quickly, please.
Reset is not. Yeah, my take on Russia is a reset button is not going to do it. Russia is very much looking out for itself. Russia is enjoying the fact at the moment that the Obama administration is handing out reset buttons and thinking that this is going to deal with everything. And countries on Russia's periphery need to watch out. You know, again, there's sort of no point at which a line has really been drawn that countries with predatory impulses or governments with predatory impulses should not go that direction. There's this mindset in Washington right now that says if we just reach out hands to our worst enemies, then things will start to go better. History is not promising on that score.
Well, Claudia, just real quickly, again, people can find your columns on Thursday. What's the website where they can see them?
Sure. They can find them all collected on the website of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, and my weekly column is on Forbes.com under the opinion section.
Great. Well, thank you so much for being with us and taking the time. We could go on for hours with you for sure, but we will have you back sometime, and thank you for all your great work. And
pleasure
we'll
to
be
here.
To you.
Thank you both. Bye-bye.
So, folks, that's going to be a wrap for today. We're, I want to thank you all for being here. Visit our website at aim.org. Sign up for our daily emails and come back next week. And for Take Aim on Blog Talk Radio. So long.